My name is Mark Sloboda. I'm a Moscow-based international relations and security analyst. I'm originally from the United States. I'm a U.S. military veteran of the nuclear engineering field. I completed my postgraduate work in international relations theory and strategic studies at the London School of Economics and Political Science. I have taught at the Moscow State University, International Relations and Security Studies, and I continue doing teaching in Moscow, as well as a little bit of geopolitical risk consulting and a whole lot of media work. I regularly do interviews, debates, commentary articles for media all over the world.
I mean, some might consider you to be a defector, Mark.
Sure. I mean, not quite in those legal terms, but I emigrated from the United States to Russia. I'm a legal immigrant to the Russian Federation. My wife is from Crimea, what used to be part of the Ukraine. And we have in-laws in Simferopol in Crimea. And we also have family all over eastern Ukraine in Donbass, Kharkov, and Odessa.
So why are you there and not somewhere like Oregon?
Because I don't like living in Oregon. I don't really, I despise American politics. My experiences in the U.S. military and seeing the literal results of the pursuit of U.S. global military hegemony and primacy around the world convinced me to spend the rest of my life in one way or another combating it. I really could not imagine living in the United States. I don't like the culture. I don't like the society. I don't like the politics. I don't like the crass consumer capitalism. I haven't been back in the United States in 20 years.
I mean, wouldn't you have stood a better chance of combating it actually from within?
No, I don't think so. I don't think anyone has successfully combated it from within, and I wouldn't want to endure it while I'm combating it. I think that the single biggest opponent to U.S. hegemony around the world has been the Russian Federation. And I don't agree with everything that the Russian government does, but I am largely on board, particularly with their foreign policy. And we have seen in Georgia, in Syria, and now in Ukraine, Russia presenting an obstacle to U.S. meddling, invasions, regime changes. Not only Russia, of course, China is quickly becoming the other part of that Sino-Russian condominium. And there are other countries as well that have been essentially forced together because of aggressive U.S. pursuit of hegemony, including, you know, of course, the attempts to ring these countries with hostile nations by meddling in their politics, investing billions of dollars to promote anti-Russian, anti-Chinese figures, promoting separatism in Taiwan, billions of dollars worth of arms, you know, all in this idea that if they can contain the rising peer competitors, then they can extend the unipolar moment of U.S. hegemony another decade or two.
So is there anything you can share with us from your experience within the U.S. military that really convinced you that that this was not going to be for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, the two things in particular that I was involved in personally was the 10-year U.S. bombing campaign of Iraq between the two wars in Iraq, which a lot of people don't know. The U.S. basically denied Iraq the overflight routes over a large portion of their own country and regularly bombed the country. The other thing I was involved in was the U.S. bombing campaign on Serbia, which, you know, I was part of the fleet that was launching cruise missiles and ballistic missiles at Serbia, destroying a whole lot of civilian infrastructure, factories, bridges, roads, that sort of thing, you know, all in the idea of carving up Serbia, creating Kosovo as a NATO protectorate led by a group that the U.S. had previously classified as a terrorist organization, the Kosovo Liberation Army, for causing some 10,000 plus deaths in Serbia through in pursuit of their idea of a greater Albania. Kosovo today continues to be a crime haven, a drug trafficking route, and of course it hosts the largest U.S. military base in Europe, Camp Bondsteel.
Yeah, so that's not quite what we've been led to believe happened in the former Yugoslavia, Mark. I mean, it was basically some maniacs on the loose, people like Milosevic, etc., that had to be basically stopped by NATO.
There were definitely some maniacs on the loose in the conflict. The U.S. was supporting them. There have been U.N. reported investigations into the Kosovo Liberation's involvement in human organ smuggling. And that is not something that, is some type of conspiracy theory. That has been reported in The Economist, citing investigations by the United Nations, although it's usually kept hushed down and not something that's talked about as at least such as will penetrate the narrative.
Anyway, in February this year, 2022, we had a few eyebrows raised as the Russian army, something like 150,000 strong, decided it was going to enter Ukraine. Were you surprised when it happened? Because there was a lot of, you could probably call it propaganda, couldn't you? Saying that it wasn't ever going, that the Russians were not going to do this. This was all NATO intelligence services fear-mongering.
I predicted, I'm one of the ones who did from as early as late November, that a Russian military intervention in late February was very much a option on the table if the diplomatic route through this flurry of basically forced meetings by Russia on an attempt to force the U.S.-backed Putin regime in Kiev to finally implement the Minsk Accords after 7 years of non-fulfillment, and broader security guarantees, namely that NATO would return to its promises in by multiple Western leaders, now incontrovertibly, proven in so many documents that NATO would not expand one step further to the east. And there's an idea presented that NATO is some type of innocuous defensive organization, and how possibly could they present a threat to Russia? Well, this is simply propaganda and nonsense. NATO is the, and I say that as a U.S. military veteran of NATO military operations, NATO is by far the most powerful and the most aggressive offensive military alliance in the world. They have never actually been used as in terms of collective defense against another state. However, they have conducted a large number of what they call out of theater military operations. We have seen their bombing and regime change in Libya, which destroyed that country and destabilized all of North Africa. We have seen them come in de facto trailing behind the United States and the UK during their bombing campaigns, invasions, regime changes, and military occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. And we have seen NATO members being principally involved in a jihadi proxy war against Syria. And when that petered out, the Western powers directly invaded and continue to militarily occupy East Syria, particularly the oil fields and the wheat that is so vitally necessary for the Syrian economy to recover and for them to rebuild their country.
Well, I mean, looking at that view of NATO, you do wonder whether this is some sort of organization that is set up to take over the world. I mean, it's just, obviously, slowly, yep. slowly but surely. Do you think that's feasible? I must admit, looking at the history of it, there were a lot of Nazis that were involved at the very early days of NATO. For example, during the Cold War, integrated straight from the German army after the end of the Second World War into yep. NATO's intelligence arms in Eastern Europe.
Not just their intelligence arms, but the first NATO Supreme Commander of Europe was actually an SS member. NATO was originally created with, as is popularized, the idea of keeping the U.S. in Europe, right? Meaning U.S. Dominance of Europe, keeping Germany down, once again, U.S. domination of Europe, and keeping the Soviet Union and then Russia out. But the truth is that, I mean, NATO's collective military spending is more than 15 times that of the Russian military budget every year. Even if you take out the United States and Canada, which are, you know, some 11 times, just the European members of NATO, their military spending is more than four times what Russia's is. Russia does not present any conventional military threat to NATO. Everyone knows that. But the specter of some type of Russian aggression against NATO members like the Baltics or Poland is used by domestic politicians in these countries, one to get themselves elected with the ever popular bogeyman of Russophobia, and secondly to fuel the military industrial complex. I mean, could you imagine what would have happened to all of these giant military industrial complex companies like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, etc., if there wasn't the specter of Russia always after the end of the Cold War? I mean, let's face it, a bunch of goat herding jihadists scattered around the greater Muslim world, just didn't quite cut the mustard in terms of big budget military items, that could be soaked into defense budgets. And we see now, I wouldn't put it quite in the terms that NATO's purpose is to conquer the world, right? That's it, kind of like bringing up the term imperialism. Yes, it is imperialism, but they're not really words or framing that has a lot of cachet. I would put it more that NATO's primary purpose today is not even to protect against Russia, because Russia doesn't really present any conventional military threat to Europe. An attack on NATO would be suicide, and Russia knows that. Likewise, a NATO military attack on Russia itself would be suicide. What is at question is the gray, formerly neutral countries in between Ukraine, of the former Soviet Union in particular, Ukraine, Belarus, Georgia, Kazakhstan, these countries that in the minds of geopoliticians who imagine the world like a giant risk board, if you do not occupy that neutral gray space on the board, then your opponent, as you see it, may occupy it and use it against you. And that's why we see such robust meddling in these countries' domestic political affairs over the last 20 years.
Well, look, you just say that Russia is no threat to Europe. Well, I mean, you try telling that to Ukrainians. That's just simply not the case, is it? They see Russia as a threat to them.
Which Ukrainians are you talking about?
Well, then? I'm talking about Ukrainians. Ukrainians.
My family. I have Ukrainians who are family. See, here's the thing. Ukraine has long been a national identity divided country between Western, largely geographic terms, between Western and Eastern Ukraine. Western Ukraine wasn't even actually part of Ukraine for centuries. Right up until 1939, it was part of the Poland, before that, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth before that. And they didn't like being brought into the Soviet Union. Like much of Eastern Europe, they had fallen to a kind of populist fascist politics. They had their own homegrown fascist leaders, Stefan Bandera, who headed the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists and its military arm, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, who welcomed the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union with fanfare, with parades, with flowers and children and so on. And they participated in the perpetuation of the Holocaust and the massacre of thousands of Poles, ethnic Poles in then Western Ukraine, so enthusiastically that even the SS was abashed and had to say, whoa, guys, calm down. And of course, Eastern Ukrainians, leftists of all stripes, and so on. Eastern Ukraine, on the other hand, is largely Russian speaking. They tend, whereas West Ukrainian national identities, its primary identity is hatred of Russia. Eastern Ukraine is very different. They are primarily Russian speaking. They view Russia as fraternal peoples. And Ukrainian politics since 1991 has been a balancing act between this domestic political divide, which is played out geopolitically between should Ukraine go to the West or to the East, right, to NATO or to Russia. And NATO kept the peace internally by having neutrality. Right. And it was actually enshrined in their constitution that they shall not join any military alliance or bloc. Then comes 2014. And in 2014, the democratically elected, however flawed, government of Viktor Yanukovych, who was overwhelmingly elected by the people of East Ukraine, was overthrown in a violent and unconstitutional putsch portrayed in Western media with the buzzword, the revolution of dignity, as if some people have dignity and some don't, and so forth, that was openly backed and orchestrated by the US and a number of European countries. After the overthrow of the government, the new regime immediately launched a abortive military operation to try to extend their control from Kiev out over the rest of the country, particularly in the east, which wanted nothing to do with this new regime. And it has to be noted that this is often presented as some type of democratic revolution, and that it could not be further from the truth. There were actually polling done, commissioned by the U.S. GONGO, the International Republican Institute, part of their Color Revolution arm, polling done during the Maidan itself. And what they actually showed was a very divided country. And this was done repeated months during the course of the Maidan insurrection. And they showed that actually a majority, a bare majority, it must be said, we're talking 50-48, and then 48-45, with a majority opposing the Maidan, right? So yes, almost a split country, but certainly not democratic. If even a bare majority of the country was opposed to the overthrow of the government, they launched this abortive military campaign to try to conquer East Ukraine, the Donbas, by force, and they were beaten in the field twice. And at that point, the U.S. and the West, NATO, are openly propping up the new regime in Kiev. They are funding it, that drip feed of tens of billions from the IMF, and militarily, they're arming it. And Russia is supporting the people of East Ukraine with much smaller sums, but a comparative amount of military aid needed to protect what territory they had in Eastern Ukraine. And this conflict eventually became a frozen conflict, but it was a conflict launched by Kiev against the people of East Ukraine by a regime that seized power that killed 15,000 people over 8 years. And during the course even of the frozen conflict, there was daily shellings and bombings of East Ukraine cities, of Donetsk and Lugansk. resulting in thousands of dead and an even larger number of crippled and injured as a result. And this went on for 8 years. This was supposed to be settled as of 2015 in a international agreement known as the Minsk Accords. This was an agreement between the regime in Kiev and the political authorities in East Ukraine, Donetsk and Lugansk, to politically reconcile the events of the conflict and of the overthrow of the government back in 2014. The guarantors of this accord were France and Germany on one side and Russia on the other. And this was approved even by the United States. It went to the UN Security Council, was passed at a UN Security Council resolution, enshrined in international law. And it had a number of steps, the drawback of military forces from the conflict zone, the bringing of OSCE peacekeepers. There was supposed to be a broad federalization, essentially autonomy granted for East Ukraine so that they could protect their cultural, political, and social rights that had been run roughshod over by the new regime in Kiev that had banned political parties left and right, reduced, tried to drive the Russian language out of the public sphere, and had basically declared the whole area of East Ukraine to be an anti-terrorist zone because the people of East Ukraine weren't Ukrainian citizens anymore. They were terrorists or they were pro-Russian separatists, all of these dehumanizing, attempts to deny these people any and all agency. But the regime in Kiev knew very well that if they implemented these accords, the regime in Kiev would collapse because they had been brought into power fighting on the streets by a vanguard of the far right, of Banderite fascist organizations from Western Ukraine, that when the military failed to respond to the new regime and implement its orders in early 2014, there were tens of thousands of defections from the military, the police, the security services, of people who quit their jobs or defected to Crimea or to Donbass because they did not want anything to do with this new regime. And you don't have to take my word for it. Even Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, actually did a report on the Ukrainian Navy, for example. The Ukrainian Navy, after the overthrow of the government in 2014, 75% of the Ukrainian Navy personnel defected or quit. 75%. Right. So not a whole lot of love for this new regime that no. sees
well,
power.
Well, look, Mark, you've got a narrative there which, you know, some people will accept, others not. But at the end of the day, the main reason supposedly for entering Ukraine that we've had from the Russian government is that it's too close to Moscow. If you look up at the Baltics, Latvia is around about the same distance, actually, and that is a NATO country. So it looks to me as if the Russians have gone into Ukraine simply because it's not in NATO.
No, actually, there are a number of reasons. There's never any just one reason for a military intervention in another country. Besides the ongoing NATOization of Ukraine on the ground, which saw some 10,000 NATO trainers and advisors in the country, a flood of arms, the United Kingdom announcing the construction of military bases, of a deal to construct military bases in Ukraine, the refurbishment of a large number of others for NATO use in Ukraine. But there was also the ongoing conflict in East Ukraine, which is just as important, if not much so, which saw the regime in Kiev mass murdering its own people and sending its neo-Nazi death squads. Yes, literal neo-Nazi death squads, despite the fact that Zelensky's father was Jewish. We're talking Azov, the Right Sector, Carpathia Siege, C-14, named after the 14 words of white supremacy. And it's not like it's a secret. Every Western major media publication in the last 8 years has done pieces about these groups saying, yeah, they're neo-Nazis. U.S. Congress actually, when in 2015, passed a resolution forbidding arms and training to Azov in particular as a neo-Nazi organization. But eventually that was dropped because this vanguard become brown shirts of the new regime were too vital. They had been integrated into the military, the police, the security services, the mainstream political parties, and the regime would collapse without them. So that was done away with. And so the West was free to arm and train these literal neo-Nazis in Ukraine. Not necessarily because they love neo-Nazis, but these particular neo-Nazis were very geopolitically useful, like jihadists in Syria, or the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 80s, or the right-wing death squads in South and Central America to kill leftist governments and trade unionists and the like. The U.S. has a long history of this. In fact, in the 1950s, they supported many of these people's grandfathers in an attempted insurrection in the Soviet Union. They had been pumping money into many of these that had just been Nazi collaborators in West Ukraine, and there was a violent little insurgency there at the very beginning of the Cold War in the 1950s, funded and armed by the CIA that was eventually petered out and resulted in large numbers in the diaspora of the United States and Canada in particular of these former Nazi collaborators. And you only have to take a look at an example for this. One, the large number of monuments across the North and Central United States and Canada to Nazi collaborators that had been erected by the Ukrainian West Ukrainian diaspora there. Or say Chrystia Freeland, who had been the foreign minister of Canada and is still within the government there. Her father was one of the collaborators from Western Ukraine. He was a propagandist for the Nazis. And it's not something that she is able to deny, although she has tried to hide it. And she certainly has offered no apology for that. And Chrystia Freeland was even just in the last month caught at a Ukrainian diaspora rally holding the red and black flag banner of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the Nazi collaborators, which has become the banner of the right sector, one of the big neo-Nazi death squads in Ukraine. So this continuing war, the banderization, if you will, referring to the particular West Ukrainian neo-Nazi leader Stepan Bandera from the World War II era, his cult of followers are often referred to as Banderites. Perhaps Nazism is the exact term. This is Ukraine's own homegrown fascism in Western Ukraine that allied with Hitler. They wanted their own independent fascist Ukraine. No matter how many other Ukrainians, whether Jews, Poles, East Ukrainians, leftists, they needed to kill to get that. And seeing that, literal neo-Nazi organizations being armed and trained and salaried, not just by the regime in Kiev, yes, despite the fact that Zelensky's father was Jewish, that's no defense. Zelensky's own oligarch patron that helped him into power. Zelensky has no political history. He is a virtual candidate. He was a comedian who played a role of a Ukrainian citizen who accidentally became the president. And his show was called Servant of the People. And Igor Kolomoisky then launched him as his candidate for control of the country and named his new political party Servant of the People after the television show. And Igor Kolomoisky, a Jewish descent oligarch, by the way, he was the primary funder of many of these neo-Nazi battalions from way back to 2014 up to the modern day. Yes, despite the fact that he's Jewish, because the truth of this is that despite the fact that, these are unquestionable neo-Nazis, for the moment, the primary objects of their hatred and violence are ethnic Russians in Ukraine and Russia itself, of course, leftists and what they refer to as Slovak East Ukrainians, i.e. East Ukrainians who don't believe that the country's founding father and hero is the Nazi collaborator Stepan Bandera. And as long as that's the case, then these are geopolitically useful neo-Nazis. And they're kosher. And there's really no other word for it. Okay. And this figment is presented that they are somehow – they can't exist, even though it's been, you know, so widely documented in the Western press. They can't possibly – oh, they're not significant, or we can just airbrush and whitewash them away because there's a Jewish descent president. That's no shame.
Yeah. I think it'd be interesting and useful if we can to talk a bit more about these ex-Soviet Union oligarchs, because many of them, of course, are not – actually Russian. They weren't born in Russia. Can you say anything about their influence? Because there was one of their most important oligarchs, Boris Berezovsky, had a bit of a tussle with Vladimir Putin in 2000 when Putin, although he was saying, I'm your friend, I'm going to try and stop you getting arrested, he warned him that he was going to get arrested and he was never able to come back to Russia. So there was almost a turning of the tables in 2000 at that point between the oligarchs and Putin, with Putin, I suppose, effectively in the noughties and more recently saying to these oligarchs, well, you can carry on your gangster activity, but step anywhere near the Kremlin and I'm going to chop your fingers off. Well, effectively, what he means is you're going to be out of the country and never come back.
Yeah. So Boris Berezovsky, there were a large number of Russian oligarchs in the 90s. And it has to be said that Ukraine today is completely still dominated by oligarchs, right? Behind every political faction, there are oligarchs, some of them warring against each other. But every television channel in the country, at least up until Zelensky just nationalized all media in the country in the last week and created one unified information policy, they're all owned by oligarchs. And Zelensky, of course, has been backed by his own oligarch patron, the former Putsch president Poroshenko. He was an oligarch himself, a candy oligarch. So Ukraine today continues to have its politics dominated by its oligarchs. But in Russia, Yeltsin era was a kleptocracy dominated by the oligarchs. And Boris Berezovsky was one of these very close to the Clinton-backed Yeltsin regime and profited from it. And when Vladimir Putin, a former agent and then director of the FSB under Yeltsin, was promoted as Yeltsin's successor when his alcoholism caught up with him and made him, you know, a living wreck of a human being, incapable of really doing much of anything, there was a belief that Putin would carry on this kleptocracy and continue to enrich what was called the family. Putin did very much the opposite, and he made the oligarchs not oligarchs. And that's often a misused term in Russia now. The deal he made with them was that you will largely get to keep your filthy lucre, but you get out of politics. You don't get to buy politicians, you don't get to buy members of the Duma, you know, Russia's parliamentarians or congressmen, you know, however you want to term it, you're out of, right? So they don't have the political influence today that, say, Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or Zuckerberg does in the United States. Boris Berezovsky very quickly ended up on the wrong side of this, as he didn't like being exiled from political power. And he ended up like so many other criminal oligarchs in the UK, from Russia. He fled to the UK, which serves as the world's biggest onshore, offshore tax haven for kleptocrats around the world, including no small number of these criminal oligarchs, previous oligarchs who have fled Russia, bringing their money with them. He continued for quite a few years to continue his attempts to, meddle in Russia's politics and perhaps launch some type of coup or something that would allow him and his ilk to return to power. But he ended up in a bad way, supposedly suicide, I very much doubt that is what actually happened. A British court had just before that, when he had tried to launch a lawsuit, found that he was completely, that they used words saying that basically you could not trust a single word that the man said, that everything come out of his mouth was lies, and continued to make, you know, character assassinating remarks about this. Well, I was someone that I and most Russians consider a rather vile little toad. And he supposedly killed himself shortly after that, whether it was MI6 or the FSB or someone else that he had crossed in many of his bad business dealings. No one really knows for sure.
Well, I would hazard a guess that it being some of his chums, possibly even connected with the Duke of Kent, who was funding him in London, who were rather irritated by his habit of wanting to tell the press everything and talk a bit too much about some of the inner workings of the international oligarchy. But anyway, I mean, we're getting a lot of talk here in the UK now about the evil Putin. I wonder what you make, Mark, of the whole concept of whether Putin is really behind this, because I understand there were some votes on the Ukraine action that took place back in the early part of February, maybe even the beginning, the end of January, about doing something about what was going on in Lugansk and the Donbass, that Putin actually has been trying to hold back on this for many years.
Yeah, I would say that definitely. I know that my family members in East Ukraine have been extremely critical of Putin because they think that he should have done something as soon as the Ukrainian government was overthrown in 2014. And they blame him for 8 years of political terror and economic dysfunction in the country since. And now that with NATO money and arms, that Kiev has rebuilt an army and the size of these neo-Nazi organizations that are fully integrated into the military, the police, and the security services have increased many fold. They have been brought into Ukrainian schools to teach little kids, right? You know, how to fire weapons and hate Russians primarily. But that is something that, you know, has long been on the political minds in Russia. And it was actually the main opposition party in Russia, the communists, that pushed a vote on recognizing the Donetsk and Lugansk as independent countries when the last round of diplomatic, attempts failed and Kiev refused to fulfill the Minsk Accords, and the U.S. and France and Germany refused to use their leverage over their new client state to do so. The communists pushed forward to recognize Donetsk and Lugansk, and that led to the whole chain of events where they continued to fire on Donetsk and Lugansk even after Russia recognized the new countries and moved troops in to protect them, which meant Russian troops and their new declared allies were being attacked, and which, you know, gave at least a figment of a legal rationale for the Russian military intervention in Ukraine, whose goals are pretty well declared at this point, and they have not budged on them since. One, that the regime in Kiev should recognize that Crimea voted freely in a referendum to get out of Dodge, that they didn't want to be part of Ukraine anymore. The people there have never really considered themselves Ukrainians. Actually, my wife was one of those who voted so overwhelmingly in the referendum, which has been you don't have to believe the Russian results. It has been confirmed in polls by Pew and Gallup and GFK and numerous other international polls since then. Unless you believe Putin controls all these Western polling agencies as well. When I first met my wife in Boston after getting out of the military, I had met her in a club, a gothic industrial nightclub, actually. And I had said, you're from somewhere in Eastern Europe. I can tell by your accent. And she said, yes, I'm from Crimea. And she said, and I said, oh, you're Ukrainian. And this was 2001. And she slapped me across the face for calling her Ukrainian, because people of Crimea never considered themselves Ukrainian. That was my first introduction to the complicated national identity and ethnic politics of Ukraine, of what was then Ukraine. So recognize Crimea chose to become part of Russia, recognize the Donetsk and Lugansk as independent countries, the promise to reintroduce the neutrality to their constitution such that they will not join NATO or for, say, the Russian-led military bloc, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, that they should return constitutionally to neutrality, interrupted in 2014. And the other two are the denazification, better termed as the debanderization of the country, and the demilitarization, which is a vague political goal, but basically means that Russia is going to annihilate the Ukrainian military's offensive capacity to make sure that they can never threaten Donetsk or Lugansk or Crimea again.
Well, look, a lot of the tactics, many people have pointed out the similar tactics, a kind of soft war where the preservation of civilians is very important. In other words, that the military engagements are often in built-up areas where there are still civilians living, rather than many historical wars, which have been, the idea is to be avoiding civilian casualties, and pointed out the similarities with the Syrian Arab Army's operations a few years ago, basically doing a similar kind of job. Now, of course, the Israelis are an interesting broker here, because they've been, so we say, irons in both fires, with a lot of Israeli money based in Ukraine too. So what do you make of the Israeli role in all of this? Because I noticed Naftali Bennett, the new prime minister or newish prime minister, has been doing quite a lot of shuttle diplomacy, because, you do wonder whether actually these Israelis have been getting a bit of a free ticket to bomb what they want to in Syria from Putin. And potentially this is, I think a lot of people are asking, what exactly is this role? And do the Israelis have the leverage to really tell Putin what to do?
First of all, no. Of course, Israel does not have any leverage to tell the president of the Russian Federation what to do. They have far more influence over the
Israelis. Well, why is it that the Israelis are able to bomb in Syria, where, the Russians actually have control of the airspace, but the Israelis are managing to do some bombing down there when they feel like it?
Okay, first of all, let me get to your characterization of the military campaign in Ukraine, because it's completely false, and you don't have to trust my word on it. You can trust the words of actual U.S. military experts, and we're talking not the pundits and the talking heads, but actually U.S. military experts on the Russian military, and I'm talking people like Michael Kaufman at the Center for Naval Analysis for the Russian military, and he's also a fellow at the Center for New American Security. Rob Lee, who a similar figure, he just finished his postgraduate work at the King's War College in the UK, actually right next to my alma mater, the LSC. He concurs. He's a Foreign Policy Research Institute fellow. The U.S. Colonel Douglas McGregor, who after his service in Iraq and Afghanistan became a major a military advisor to several U.S. presidents since. There's an article out in Newsweek today. Putin's bombers could devastate Ukraine, but he's holding back. Here's why. And they go on to cite a large number of serving U.S. military and defense intelligence analysts to say, well, the way that the conflict is being presented is entirely false, actually, that Russia is going out of their way not only to prevent as many civilian casualties as possible, but also to prevent casualties among the regular Ukrainian military, that most of their targeting has been restrained, that actually in the first 24 days of the conflict, Russia launched less air sorties and strikes than the United States did in the first day of the Iraq war, right? One day, This is not a shock and awe campaign. A lot has been played up when you have seen these battalions or perhaps some of the Ukrainian military take up residence in some what had previously been civilian buildings, provoking the Russian military to fire on them and then claiming some type of mass attack on civilians, you know, despite the fact that there's only been, you know, the civilian deaths is in the hundreds at this point after a month of this large scale military combat. And Russia has actually hindered and slowed and caused a lot of problems for the goals of their military operation by this. And it has resulted in a lot more Russian military deaths than is necessary in pursuit of these goals and may have, you know, really thrown a wrench actually into it. And that's why U.S. military analysts have had such a hard problem understanding what Russia is doing there.
I want to drag you back to talking about Israel. What's the Israeli role? And what about this comparison with the mopping up operations in Syria? Because it seems a similar kind of warfare that the Russians have been involved with before.
Yeah, I mean, it is similar, although your characterization of it is wrong, and you have to take a look at the liberation of East Aleppo for that, and that was presented as some type of massacre of civilians and mass destruction of the city, and nothing could have been further from the truth. The most extreme elements were isolated, units that could be compromised were talked down and settled with, and then, you know, force was used where necessary, and actually civilian, you know, collateral damage was kept to a minimum, and minimal damage for any type of urban combat was done to the city. It was not like Fallujah. It was not like Mosul. It was not like Raqqa, where the U.S. leveled the cities when it went into them. Israel has of course, had a complicated role in Syria because, you know, despite being a Jewish state, they were funding a large number of these jihadist Islamist groups in southern Syria, you know, throughout the course of, you know, from some 2011 up till 2018 or so, because Syria was a geopolitical opponent. Syria was allied with Iran, and Iran is the enemy of both Israel and the United States. So, you know, again, there's no problem using proxies, you know, however unideologically aligned with you they may be, you know, because they're geopolitically useful. But there was basically deals made with Israel. The U.S., of course, did not, or Russia did not want to get involved in the Syrian-Israeli, shall we say, Cold War. They went there for a military purpose to make sure that the government in Damascus did not collapse and to fight the jihadists and Islamists, not to fight a war with Israel. That, of course, would draw in the United States, and that would be World War III. So Russia basically made a deal. The Russian government made a deal with the Israeli government that, look, we don't want to get involved in your business with Damascus or your business with Iran, but we're here to conduct a military operation. So here's the deal. You've been used to violating Syria's sovereignty with the rest of your neighbors as some type of rogue state, making military attacks willy-nilly with complete impunity for decades now. We're not going to interfere with that as long as you don't attack primarily Syrian government targets. If you target Hamas and say Iranian forces allied with the Syrian government and do it in a restrained fashion such that your claims of self-defense are even, however implausibly, you know, at least a token believable, we will look the other way and we will not allow the Syrian government to use the S-300 systems that we have erected in the country, and we won't use our air defense to stop you. But do not get in the way of our military operation, and do not, you know, result in any type of serious attack on the Syrian government or its forces. And largely that has been kept too. It has resulted in the shooting down of a Russian military aircraft, something that Israel definitely had to make some concessions on. And Israel has had more restrained bombing of Syria than they have had in the past, and has resulted only to strikes out of Lebanese airspace and so on. But it's a complicated geopolitical dance, you know, something where that is quite common with many countries. Russia has its complicated dance with Saudi Arabia, like the U.S. does with Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Qatar and so on. But, you know, that's real politics. With regards to the events in Ukraine, Naftali Bennett came and spoke to both Zelensky and to Putin. And he came out of that. And according to Ukrainian sources from the Ukrainian government, he suggested to Zelensky that he should surrender and meet the Russian terms in order to, you know, save civilian lives in Ukraine. They later denied that that was true, but it seems plausible. Then Zelensky, just a couple of days ago, gave a video address to the Knesset, pleading for military aid, pleading for arms, and like he had done to the U.S. Congress, the Canadian Parliament, basically every big European parliament and so on. And he created quite a storm. First of all, the Palestinian representatives, what are called Arab Israelis, those Palestinians who actually have representation as living and being Israeli citizens. It's a minority, but they're there. They walked out. They had no intention of listening to Zelensky. They said that NATO expansion is the cause of this conflict, and they stand with Russia. So there was 55 delegates from the Israeli Knesset just walking out right there. And then Zelensky tried to play the Holocaust card, or shall we say his Jewish descent card, and tried to compare the Russian military intervention in Ukraine as some type of Holocaust or final solution. All the more ironic because however much the Israelis have their own geopolitical games, they know that Zelensky has state-armed and funded neo-Nazi death squads in his country. Yeah, their violence isn't principally targeted at Ukrainians, Jews for the moment, but you know, there's always the issue of later and after. They dealt with their or they think they can deal with their more present issues. So the Knesset said, you know, that these kind of comparisons are ridiculous. They are unforgivable. They are entirely inappropriate. And no, we're not going to give arms to you. And we're going to stay neutral on this subject of the Russian military intervention there. We're not taking Russia's side or Ukraine's side. So that's one, you know, attempted begging for arms deal that Zelensky at least did not get out of. Israel has been supplying arms to Ukraine, to the Kiev regime's forces over the last 8 years in small amounts. And some of that may continue covertly, but certainly he's not going to get any type of large scale public acknowledgement or shipments like he has gotten from other, you know, Western NATO countries, for instance.
Also, I wonder if we can look at the sort of NATO political lobbies work in all of this. One of my colleagues that runs the WikiSpooks website made the comment that because these Bilderberg conferences have just vanished off the face of the earth. Now, the Bilderberg was set up. I mean, I've done quite a lot of research and work on them for years. Back after the Second World War, about 10 years after World War II, for the first 20 years, it was chaired by a former SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was then caught doing getting a $1 million bribe from Lockheed to get the Dutch Air Force to buy their rather shoddy starfighter jets. And then he had to resign. But anyway, the Bilderberg has vanished off the face of the earth since COVID, and it's not really supposed to exist or be thought about. And yet WikiSpooks has pointed out that something like 150 Bilderberg attendees over the last decade or so have been intimately involved in the whole COVID-19 lockdown program, the vaccines, the technology involved in the vaccines, making a lot of money from that, in the media suppression of cheap pills which will help you, you know, stop you going to hospital with COVID, etc. And now, of course, we've got this major, you know, basically a war in Europe, which is beginning to, NATO is getting rather confident. So I just wonder what you make of the think tanks like the Bilderbergs, and particularly about the idea that they're supposed to have vanished off the face of the earth.
Okay, well, I don't believe any more than you do that they have vanished off the face of the earth. I will, you know, come right out and say I'm not an expert on the Bilderberg Group. You are far more knowledgeable on that than I am. I know certainly there aren't any current members of the group who are members of the Russian government. I believe there were one or two at the height of the Clinton-backed Yeltsin kleptocracy in the
90s. Yeah, it's also probably, sorry to interrupt you, but it's probably worth pointing out as well that Klaus Schwab and Prince Charles's World Economic Forum is fascinating to look at the board of that, because again, it's a bit of China, a bit of the NATO countries, some other nations which are aligned with them, but no Russians at all.
Yeah, well, that you know, dovetails right with the type of existential economic war that's being waged on Russia for daring to try to flip back the new U.S. client state in Kiev. I'm sure the Bilderberg will be getting back together then. I will admit to a little bit more knowledge on a similar one of these transnational elite groups, the Trilateral Commission, which you're probably familiar with from your research on the Bilderberg Group.
Mark, our leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, is a long-term
member of that.
As
is Jake Sullivan and Antony Blinken, the Biden's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. And, you know, it's one of these critics accuse the Trilateral Commission of promoting a global consensus among international ruling classes, largely Western, in order to manage international affairs in the interests of financial and industrial elites under the trilateral umbrella. Something that I believe is kind of duplicated in fashion, if a little more informally, with the Bilderberg Group. But you could probably speak to the parallel there a bit better than I can.
Yeah, well, I think the reason I brought it up is because it does appear to me that that this is a kind of fascist system we've now got in the West, where big corporations, led by the banks, I guess, but also private companies, like, for example, your Shells, the big energy companies, seem to be far more powerful than our political parties, and they're actually in most of the West, democracy is on the back foot here.
Yeah, well, I mean, this goes all the way back to Truman warning about the power of the military-industrial complex in the U.S. And you've probably noticed that the stocks of all of these giant U.S. military companies since the Russian military intervention started have gone through the roof. They are loving life right now. They are popping champagne, talking about expansion. In the last week, the Canadian government of Trudeau and just today, the United States has announced that they need to replenish their supplies of a large number of regularly stocked military equipment like anti-tank weapons, the U.S. Javelin, the British NLAW, manpads like the Stinger, but a whole host of other military equipment, because they've given so much of it to the regime in Kiev at this point. And they need to buy more. And in response, we've already heard from a consortium of these big defense companies that they say we need more military factories in the United States, right? And that's where we're going forward. And because I call it the great decoupling, we are seeing a huge geopolitical split. The unipolar world, I think you can definitively say, is dead now, right? The last nail on the last nail of the coffin has been driven in. But rather than a multipolar world, we are seeing a new bipolar world emerge. The bipolar world, or the multipolar world, is stillborn. It has been killed by the attempts of the U.S.-led Western hegemony, you know, NATO being principal among that, to hold on to hegemony and that unipolar moment as long as they can, driving countries like Russia and China and Iran and a whole host of other countries together, where their interests might not have been otherwise. And that has become a major fixture of the system at this point. And the economic war on Russia, I mean, there has already been not quite to the same extent, but leveled against China, against Iran, and that is only set to accelerate. And that is pushing the world economy apart. Restrictions by the U.S. state-affiliated tech and social media giants, Meta, Alphabet, Google or Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, clearly siding with the U.S. government, shutting out voices of other governments' medias. Whether that's the Russian or the Iranian or so far, identifying them as state affiliated, but not ours, of course, so on. Driving of Western companies out of Russia in some type of woke cancel culture frenzy shows the clear synergy between the U.S. government and corporate power in the United States and Western countries in general. And now this is all there's a big NATO meeting set up where this is going to be extended to China, because China is not, you know, submitting itself to the line, is not taking sides in the Ukrainian conflict, or you could say is very quietly taking Russia's side, because they know they're next and Russia is their primary bilateral relationship in the world and strategic partner.
I wonder if we could just look briefly at the China Eastern 737 crash on Monday, Mark. What do you make of that?
I don't know anything in particular about that. Airline accidents happen. I have not seen anything in particular that makes me believe some type of something necessarily nefarious has happened.
Well, I'll tell you what is. My background is in aviation, and
yes,
this aircraft, the descent, if you look at the altitude, the speed of the aircraft, which is available online in various places, including the Professional Pilots Rumor Network, it follows exactly the pattern of the 2018 Lion Air 737. And I mean, I don't like to call them crashes, because these aircraft were at cruise altitude. They start wobbling around. It's as if the crew are struggling to control the aircraft. It's dropping by several thousand feet in a minute or whatever. So obviously a very rough ride up there. And then it basically points its nose to the ground on power, and it's a power dive into the deck. Now this is the same exact pattern as those two previous crashes, which were put down to the flight control system, which could potentially be hacking. And looking at Vault 7 back in, I think that was 2017, Julian Assange released that. He showed that these hacking tools are out there. He in fact published the manuals to them to hack many, many things, including our TVs, cars, that kind of stuff. But anyway, I wonder if you could just say what you make of Assange, because it's he's got married this week to Stella Morris in Belmarsh Prison. 15 minutes they were allowed for their marriage, and a big party outside, Mark.
Yeah. I was years ago, I was already part of these online, groups of people who, prominent people in media and politics. Not that I'm necessarily that prominent, but I was invited and talked about Assange, and I talked about how, well, you know, back already still when he was in the British embassy, that what was going to happen is what is happening right now, that he was never going to be released because they needed to make an example out of him. That they cannot allow the precedent to lead to more leaks, more whistleblowers out of the U.S. military and security services like Assange or Snowden, and that they were going to have to, make they were going to have to make a lesson out of him. His life has become ever more miserable since, and now he will be in charge of the the U.S., quote, justice system, unquote. And, you know, we've all saw what happened to Jeffrey Epstein. in that situation, a man who knew too much or presented too much of an enemy to the system. And it has to be said that actually Assange has been focused himself, if you read his political writings, on the threat presented by U.S.-led global hegemony for a long time. And he's talked particularly about the collusion between big tech companies, Google, you know, the social media giants, Microsoft, and others. He wrote articles about it, but he also wrote a book about it, Why Google Is Not What It Seems. And he talked in it about their attempts to co-opt him, how a number of people who had been in and out of the U.S. State Department and the top leadership of Google and several of these other big tech companies, because it's a revolving door, had came to him and basically tried to co-opt him while he was still in London. And it's a fascinating account how they have basically served as a separate foreign policy arm of the U.S. government, pursuing their own types of meddling in politics and color revolutions, even in countries like Azerbaijan under the table. I think it's really necessary, very interesting reading. And Why Google Is Not What It Seems, I strongly recommend it. Assange is not going to end well. You know, it's one of those particular cases. Of course, he's not a U.S. citizen, and he was doing the job of a journalist, despite the number of Western mainstream media journalists that despise and hate him and cheer on what has been done to him, which says far more about him.
The thing is, he wasn't the man who knew too much. He was the man who was told too much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, he encouraged more whistleblowers to come forward and provided a platform for that and published the results, even if mostly, you know, just in aggregate form. And that's something that cannot be allowed to continue, because that's too much truth, right? That's too much exposure.
Yeah, I mean, it may be. I mean, what you were saying earlier about the Crimea and the Ukrainian Navy, that actually the way that the Western leadership is behaving is actually actively encouraging people to basically change sides. And of course, if they do that, then there needs to be in the world of journalism somewhere they can turn. It's no point in going to The Guardian, who will tell you, oh, well, that's very interesting information that you've got, but we're not going to publish it. And you would
not anymore. Not after MI6 cracked the hammer down on them. MI5.
Well, it's that. Yeah, but I mean, you know, this happened again also with one of the most important stories of the last decade here, which was the expose of Jimmy Savile, the BBC friend of Prince Charles, paedophile, the worst paedophile in British history. Even that story couldn't be told. It took Miles Goslett, who'd got the information about Newsnight killing the story, with an old colleague of mine, Liz McKean, saying that, oh, we've got a Jimmy Savile special at Christmas, we can't possibly talk about anything like that. And he had to run around all of the newspapers in London and eventually ended up at the Oldie magazine about 18 months later. And they finally published it. And then I think it was about 8 months later, the financiers of the Oldie newspaper sacked Richard Ingrams, who'd founded it. So there's really nowhere to go for anybody who's a whistleblower. I wonder what you make of this. I mean, in a way, you're a bit of a whistleblower yourself, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, not, you know, with any vitally crucial facts or something, but certainly someone who came out of the system to oppose it, you know, in such ways as I can, which is mostly just analysis and talk. Yeah, I mean, we call the media the fourth estate for a reason, right? Because it is an integral part of our political systems in Western countries. And I don't think it's so much a matter of the government controls the media or vice versa. Is it that their interests, so, you know, first of all, our media is corporate controlled. We know that, right? It's a for-profit industry. And their interests clearly align with that of our states. There is such a synergy between them. It is tantamount to the type of synergy you see between the government and big tech, or the government and the military industrial complex, with all kinds of revolving doors between government positions and top editorships, you know, at the biggest papers and television stations there. I mean, who is providing military and political analysis on the Western, in the U.S. media right now? James Clapper, the former director of national intelligence, right? The former director of the CIA, and dozens of other high and mid ranking CIA officials and so on. Why get your propaganda through a middleman, right? You don't even need that anymore. They come out of the intelligence services and are brought right into the television media audience as analysts, telling the American people, you know, what to think about foreign events and international affairs and something. It's not even a conspiracy. It's all done in the open. It's something that is undeniable, but something that is just never questioned anymore. When really it should be. And if you're watching some of these press conferences, like, the media are actually bigger warmongers sometimes than the politicians, often actually restrained by the sanest people in the room, which are sometimes the military brass, pushing Joe Biden. Why isn't there a no-fly zone, which would mean attacking the Russian Air Force over Ukraine? Why aren't we intervening? I mean, they're asking, repeating the questions again and again. How can you let Ukrainian babies die? You know, all this type of it's really frightening. And this is coming from a press that is pushing for war, because they have become so used to the uninterrupted, unrestrained use of U.S. military might around the world at the slightest pretense for the last 30 years of invasions, bombing, regime change, occupations, and everything. The idea that the U.S. is restrained in this position by a peer competitor with an equal nuclear arsenal that it can't directly challenge infuriates them. You know, it challenges primacy.
Well, there's something else, which is, I mean, obviously we've seen the shutdown of RT, which many people in Britain have relied on to get both sides of the story, having been getting basically propaganda from pretty much every other outlet, pro-Western propaganda, and you know, people need both sides to make their mind up.
I've been a regular in RT for years, even more so Sputnik, but I also do Chinese media and Indian media and Pakistani media and South American, you know, everyone, except of course for a lot of Western media. I'm not so welcome there, except in some.
No, I think, you know, this is the thing. It's a bit like with COVID. I'd like to see both sides, and I would trust a media outlet.
And you should.
For example, had Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who started the scandal here in Britain about the links between the measles, mumps and rubella jabs and autism, who was a genuine doctor, and Bill Gates, who seems to be lecturing the world. I'd like to see a 2-hour live debate with these guys, between these guys. And, I, you know, that's the sort of thing I think would that's what television, that's why people have gotten into myself, into journalism, is to get experts on both sides to debate live without any holds barred. In other words, so you're not going to say, well, we can't ask this, we can't ask that, just to take it, the thing, wherever it goes. That's real television, and it's real media. But we're not getting very much of that anymore. We get this bipolar world that you're talking about. And I wonder, you know, in the nuclear age, now it seems a much more serious conflict, actually, between East and West. And we're not really talking about the people at all here. We're talking about, you know, governments who are, and militaries who are, absolutely ideologically opposed. And there's really unlikely to be much meeting of minds. Although the Russians, I see Sergei Lavrov still talks about his Western colleagues and this kind of thing, which I think is the right language to
too
use.
Too much but of anyway, a gender.
What do you make of people who are saying that this actually could lead to a third world war with some sort of casus belli in Ukraine, maybe with a bit of Nazi help? And maybe even the end of the world.
Okay, first of all, quickly back to the media thing. I think you're exactly right. Like, for instance, I certainly don't agree with everything that RT publishes, even though I've contributed a lot there, or Sputnik, or CGTN, or media everywhere. But I spend hours every day perusing media stories from media all over the world in different languages in different countries to try to ascertain, you know, some analysis of what is really happening from some type of triangulation of facts or something. And managing information flows is a major part of modern life. You know, there is an information war. It's very real. And it's beyond most people's ability to, you know, sort through it. It's just simply the time and the expertise that's involved. I've been, for instance, extremely critical of the Russian government's COVID-19 policy from the very beginning. And vocally and on Russian media. I simply, my criticisms of the Russian government on that and other issues are not what a Western liberal Democrat's criticisms of the Russian government have been. So I'm right on board with you there. You have to peruse and make up your own mind, but increasingly you're not even allowed to view that. And the West started it. Russia is following suit, tit for tat, after having Russian media shut down. But it's become a smaller world, and it will be a much smaller internet, a splintered internet, as a result of that. I would have said, you know, even a few weeks ago, that the chance of some type of confrontation, direct confrontation between Russia and NATO in Ukraine, was, you know, leading to, potentially to a World War III type scenario was unlikely. But I have seen several things coming out of the West in recent last few days that have really started to make me worry. One of those, there's a big NATO meeting coming up. I think I said it earlier. And the talk is about sending NATO peacekeepers, or perhaps just Polish peacekeepers, backed up by NATO, quote, peacekeepers into Western Ukraine, occupying, you know, with, you know, to support the regime in Kiev as it retreats, you know, from Kiev and the east of the country. No one knows where Zelensky actually is at this point. Is he in Kiev? It almost seems not, with his green screen presentations. But is he in Lvov? Is he in Poland? No one really knows. Maybe he's already taken up an apartment with Juan Guaido and Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, and they can all pretend to be presidents of countries promoted by the U.S. together. I don't know. But there's very much a possibility now being seriously considered of sending peacekeepers, NATO military, or at least Polish military, which is a NATO member, into West Ukraine. And Russia is very soundly warning that's going to lead to direct Russian NATO conflict. And while the no-fly zone has been shut down and raised again, and the politicians keep talking about it and promoting it, and the military in the U.S. keeps saying, no, that's not a good idea. You can't do that. No, that would mean war with Russia. We're not going to do that. Politicians, again, seem bent on you know, the idea that they cannot be defied in Ukraine, that this regime that they helped put in place in 2014 will continue. And that Russia must be punished. It's starting to make me worry. You know, that this is beyond. I mean, obviously, the economic effects are already touching everyone in the world, right? You can't cut a major global commodity supplier and one of the top 10 economies in the world out of the globalized economy and not have severe shocks to the system. The price of energy has gone through the roof. Europe, their economies are not sustainable without Russian energy in greater quantities than they're getting. The price of gasoline in the U.S. through the roof. Russia's the number one supplier of wheat and several other grains and sunflower seeds to the world, which are most of the world uses for cooking oil, you know, outside of the West. It's going to lead to a huge increase in inflation, prices. Companies are already going out of business in Europe. In the first world, it will mean inflation and jobs lost and so on. In Northern Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, it's going to mean famine, starvation, and mass political instability, right? The last time this happened was in prices rose even a fraction of this high was in Egypt when Mubarak's government was overthrown. Egypt is the number one wheat importer of the world, in a kind of ironic reversal from their ancient history as the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. Egypt is terrified at this point. And countries around the world are now hoarding what wheat they have, what grains they have, because the whole global distribution system is threatening to shut down on that, on a whole host of other issues. Palladium, neon gas used to make semiconductor chips, aluminum used for the airline industries and a lot of defense. This is going to be a huge economic shock, not just for Russia, which it will be. It's not causing, you know, the collapse of the Russian economy just quite yet. Things are still pretty much continuing as normal, but I do expect that the effects will grow. But there's equal blowback of this economic war on the whole global economy now, and I think you're going to see a not quite global economy come out of this whole thing within a couple of years.
What about a World War III, though? Because we've got this powder keg down in the Middle East, haven't we, as well, to add to it. And it, you know, the Russians are already down there. If things kick off down there, too, I mean, it may even be something that happens in Ukraine. It almost seems as if there's various, saucepans on the cooker that are coming up to the boil. Yeah.
Okay, so the Russian military and the U.S. military, I mean, we're talking the U.S. military, occupation of East Syria have successfully deconflicted for 7 years now, amazingly enough. But there are so many new, like, there's no rules to this game anymore. The first Cold War, there was respect. There was fear. There was respect. There were rules of the game. There was a whole architecture of treaties made, to reduce the possibility, to increase understanding and mechanisms between the countries. And the U.S. has pulled out of them over the last two decades. They pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. They pulled out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. They pulled out of the Open Skies Treaty. They have run all over the Conventional Armed Forces in Europe Treaty, the NATO-Russia Founding Act, so many, right? There's nothing left. I mean, the New START is the last piece that's left. And right now, we have been, since the pulling out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, we have been involved in a new arms race around the world, a arms race between the U.S. and Russia and China and the European Union and even India. And one example, just one example of that, right? There's cyber warfare, there's electronic warfare, there's artificial intelligence, which is going to be a huge part. Putin talks about that continually, about the threat that presents to the world. But hypersonic weapons were developed and have been most successful in Russia, although the China and the U.S. are not too far behind. As a response to the U.S. pulling out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty and putting missile defense up in Europe, saying we need to preserve our strategic deterrent. We can't allow a potential first strike capability being successful by the United States, no matter, you know, how many years it takes. So we have to have a missile that can evade U.S. air defense in Europe. And that's the hypersonic weapons that Russia has today and has demonstrated, not with nuclear warheads, but with ballistic precision warheads in a couple of times now in Ukraine. And they reduce response times. Right. So that leaders, when they have to consider a possible retaliatory strike, there's birds in the air. They have now just a couple minutes to make that decision, whether that is a real attack incoming or a computer glitch or a radar mistake or something. And there's no rules. There's no respect. And the U.S. is pushing so hard to provoke Russia and China. Right. It's not just Russia at this point. The U.S. Biden administration is doing saber rattling naval parades off China's own coast on the other side of the world every month. Now they're massing arms promoting separatism of Taiwan, despite formally recognizing the one China policy that Taiwan is part of China. All of these accidents that the U.S. has had in the South China Sea, with a submarine running aground, naval ships, air accidents, and with landing on an aircraft carrier, et cetera. It's because they're doing so many military operations there, once again, in China's backyard. That's another flashpoint. And it's becoming an increasingly dangerous world. And I think that it is now potentially more dangerous than the Cuban Missile Crisis, which you know, was actually precipitated by U.S. missiles in Turkey and then a Soviet response by putting missiles in Cuba. What I would have said before was an extremely small chance, like a fraction of a percentage point chance, is now up to, you know, something that is countable in full percentage points. And when we're talking nuclear war, that's something that should not be that high. And it's, because of the potential consequences of it. And it's now something that I have not worried about it for years, but now I'm actually starting to worry about it.
Yeah, and I suppose in conjunction with the cliff edge that we're on economically, I mean, this could be an enormous cataclysm. Anyway, look, Mark, just to end on a positive note, whereabouts are good places to follow your work? And also maybe you'd like to share with us a couple of websites, because obviously we can't switch on our TV and watch you or anyone pretty much sensible anymore. So whereabouts can we go to get some news? I mean, obviously you're a bit of a news hunter yourself. You're saying you're on there every day.
Yes.
Give us a couple of tips, would you?
Okay, well, first of all, I'm active on social media. You should still be able to get me there. I'm still a blue check. They haven't pulled that off of me yet. On Twitter, that's where I'm probably most active, and I use Twitter like a news feed. I'm on Facebook and Vkontakte and other social media sources too. Political radio shows. I'm on there several times a day, but I'm also on. Televised media like CGTN and RT and other sources as well. So
they're blocked. They're basically blocked over here now. I mean, I can't get Nick at all, for example. Even the website won't come up.
Are there any good international
sources, do you think, that you can point out?
Learn to use a VPN. Like everyone else does. That's what I would say. Use a identification hider on the internet. I use two different browsers with VPNs so that I can access the things in the Western media that are now restricted in Russia, and the things from another browser to access the things that the Western media has restricted viewing from the Russian media and other medias around the world. So that's what we're down to. I'm not big in any international media that you can other than following me on Twitter.
I can remember the golden age of television in the 1970s, and this is seems to me the end of the golden age of the internet. Anyway,
it is. I wrote exactly that. There's a big thread on the top of my Twitter. I call it a big long thread that talks through all the consequences of this conflict and the existential war of sanctions. And I talk that this is one of the things is this is of the great decoupling, and this is the end of the golden age of the internet, of the global internet. And you will tell your kids about it. And we're going to be looking at a splintered and much more controlled internet everywhere going forward.
Amazing. Anyway, look, the $64,000 question, when is this operation in Ukraine going to be over? How long?
Never. There's going to be a forever war. I mean, in Ukraine, the country was too politically, socially, politically divided to begin with. This whole chain has been set off. Russia cannot militarily occupy West Ukraine without a bloody insurgency that will last forever. And, it can't be reversed in Eastern Ukraine. The West would face a bloody insurgency. What has happened in the Donbass for the last 8 years there as well. Humpty Dumpty has fallen, and all the king's horses and men can't put it back together again. Ukraine will probably end up being a Balkanized state with a number of localized conflicts going forward. And I don't expect relations between the West and Russia and increasingly China and, the other parts of that bloc to ever return to what they were. We're now in a new world order, a new international system. And this is one of those big pivot points in history. It's happening right now. You want to talk about an iron wall or a new Cold War or, great power conflict, but it's here. It's now, it's happening right now. And our lives are all going to be changed coming out the other side, mostly for the worse.
Okay. Well, Mark Slobodin, thanks very much for you? I mean, surely, I mean, there must be something positive to say out of all of this, because, you know, it's at the end of the, I mean, Catherine Austin Fitz put it like this. She said, it's a war on God, but God's going to win.
There's a chance that climate change won't get a chance to destroy the world, because we'll destroy it first.
Okay. All right, Mark Sloboda, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.